session to your conference agenda.
City Charter.
Law firm Markowitz Herbold. Everybody, give it up for Markowitz Herbold. Okay, by the way, I gotta be honest. When I come to these conferences, I always do look for a session by them because I do really like what they have to share. So I just really love, you know, what they're putting out for us. I want to introduce David Faria, an attorney with Markowitz Herbold, to say a few words. They are one of our sponsors this morning. Please give it up for David Faria.
I know, it's tough. Good morning. My name is Dave Faria. I'm an attorney at Markowitz Herbold. And this is my third year attending the conference. And it's really one of the highlights of when I have to go out on the road and do these spiels. Because we actually need to have a conference. So my firm is proud to have represented dozens of cities throughout the state on a wide range of issues. Revising on first amendment issues, helping different stakeholders navigate employment matters, and involving environmental disputes. Our firm also represented the League of Oregon Cities before the United States Supreme Court in the Grants Pass case. And the majority of the opinion several times during our conference.
That's a big deal, guys.
And we're happy to give advice and advise on this kind of approach. I know things like that's advice.
Can you speak up a little? We can't hear you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. I'll do it all again. So our firm wrote an amicus brief on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities that was quoted multiple times in a majority opinion in the Grants Pass case.
Yeah.
And that case gave real guidance on an issue that I know all of you are working on, which is the housing crisis. And it at least gave a framework that you can now at least start to address some of those issues. So I look forward to speaking over the course of the next several days. Please feel free to come up and ask me questions. Our marketing person gave me new business cards, so I'm happy to hand those out. And now I want to introduce Patty Mulleville to start off the session.
Sorry, David.
No. My script says that.
That's right. Thank you, David. I would now like to introduce our speaker. When I first was elected, I recall attending an elected essentials training. Did anyone else attend an elected essentials, right? Offered by the League of Oregon Cities. This was an invaluable training to understand better our responsibility, role, and what to do and not to do as the elected body serving our community. Patty was leading that training then, and I've always found her trainings and big, municipally-minded brain to be such an asset for us and for Oregon. Fun fact, when not supporting our 241 cities, Patty is reading, just reading. And if you ask her, she'd say she's behind schedule in the number of books she's read. In 2025, she read 280. I think I can count on one hand. Like, no, just, I don't know. This year, she's read thus far 78. So let's give it up. And let's just hurry it up. Like, we should just really get on with this because she's got books to read. But let's hurry up and get on to this session so we can get her back to her stories. Please join me in welcoming the Patty Mulvihill, our executive director.
Thank you, CM, and thank you again to Markowitz Herbold. I know I said it was a big deal. That firm has really gone above and beyond for all cities in Oregon, and it's helped for the League of Oregon Cities. I think most of you know my background is as a practicing attorney. And while I never had any plans or goals to speak or practice in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, it's virtually unheard of for the Supreme Court to quote from somebody's brief, and they did it at least five or six times from the Markowitz brief on your behalf. They're a solid firm. They're building their local government city practice. So if you have concerns or needs, please seriously call them. They have done a lot of work for us both publicly and privately, and they are on my short list of firms that we use at the League whenever we need legal assistance. So please keep them in mind. We're going to talk today about charters. For those of you who haven't seen me present before, I'm incapable of standing behind this podium. I have failed if I do not account for at least 5,000 steps during this training session. I'm a big believer that lectures are incredibly freaking boring unless you all ask questions, but I'm also a big believer in that you don't get to monopolize the conversation and be the only question asker in the room. And if we're going to get to that issue later on, I will say it's a great question, give me 10 minutes and we'll get to it later. So the goal is that we get at least through the content so that everybody gets anything. I'm here all day tomorrow, honestly not leaving till probably 8 a.m. Saturday morning, so if you still have questions afterwards, you can track me down and we can go through it. Sound good?
Good.
Okay, great. So we're going to talk about charters. How many of you have updated your charter in the last 5 years?
It's going to be on the ballot.
In the ballot, okay. How many still have your original charter?
2000.
There's no shame. That's okay. All right, that's good. How many of you are thinking about amending your charters? We're in the process. Okay, good. So I am a huge municipal geek. I love charters. If I could make an entire career out of doing only two things, it would be reviewing and writing municipal code and charter amendments and teaching classes like this. I'm not ever going to have that job, but that's the dream. So what we're going to talk about, because that requires me being in private practice and I don't know how to do that. So today's session, we're going to talk about why you should be reviewing. We're going to talk about some emerging trends, what the league considers yellow and red flags in existing charters, things for you to think about, the processes that work well, and then processes that sometimes cause hiccups in charter reviews. Okay? We'll walk through all of those. Nobody has questions yet, right? Good job. Okay, so why review? First and foremost, one of the main reasons why people review charters is because sometimes you are legally required to change your charter. If your charter references a state statute or a state or federal constitutional provision, and those statutes change, or there's a new interpretation on that statute, your charter may also have to change. Now, typically, that's where your city attorney should be advising you, you have to make some changes, but it can happen. So there was a big case, Mark, I'm not picking on you, but there was a big case for the city of Corvallis about voter-approved annexations, that was like 7 years ago, right? Yeah. About 7 years ago. And the city of Corvallis got sued, alleging that its charter didn't work with state law. There was a whole bunch of legal nuances I'm not gonna get into because you'll be bored and it'll take too long. But they essentially lost, and so what happens is a court opinion basically says their charter provision doesn't do what they think it does, and now we have a problem. So sometimes you have to, out of necessity, actually change your charter. And then the rest are really more what I would call suggestions for when you do it. If the complexity of city issues gets too much to work within your current framework. So everybody in here represents or works for a city, right? Nobody from the state. We love the city. How many of you think that the way your city operates today is the same way it operated 50 years ago? Think? One or two? Okay. Mike, well, you have like less than 300 people. How many of you think that your city still operates and functions the way it did 20 years ago? A few? Even 10 years ago, pre-pandemic. The problem is your structure may no longer match what you actually have to face and deal with, right? 20, 30 years ago, most of you weren't having to deal with some of the public safety crises you're having to deal with. Wildfires weren't to the same extent. Natural disasters weren't happening. You didn't have as big of an unhoused population. You didn't have as many land use preemptions imposed upon you. The way you operate today looks very different. Mayor Johnson, you can come sit in the front row. Everybody, Mayor Johnson. So, when I talk about the complexity of issues, at the end of the day, your city charter is your foundational constitutional document. Before you take any action, before you pass any ordinance or any rule, at the end of the day, it needs to comply with your charter. If the charter no longer fits the way you need to manage your operations, then you need to be doing a charter review and possibly updating it. The other one, and I'm going to use this client, is perceived and real ineffectiveness. All of you know that sometimes you are actually very effective, and neither the press nor the public believe you. Is that fair? Right? We get complaints, we seldom get compliments. But I've also been practicing law for almost 30 years, and the reality is sometimes the perception matters more than the facts on the ground. It really does. Or else you spend the entire time just combating myths and perceptions. So if you are no longer deemed to be effective, maybe you need to change your charter. And some examples of perceived or real ineffectiveness is, how many of you have wards? Anybody have wards? A few of you. There's been a push lately to move to wards because people are saying, hey, look, everybody on the city council is from the east side of town. They don't care about what happens on the west side. They don't care about what happens on the north side because they don't live there and they don't see the problems. They don't own businesses in the area and I'm not actually being represented. That may not be true at all. Your council may care about the entire city. But if all you're hearing about is you don't care about me because all of you live on the east side, you may want to think about wards. Another big example is some of our mid to bigger cities, right? Any mayors in here get paid more than $100 a month? Okay, shh. Lower your hands. Don't be a shh. They'll throw things at you. Most mayors are not full-time paid employees. But a lot of mayors, it's your full-time job. And a lot of the mayors in some of our really big cities spend the entire legislative session in Salem with me at the legislature. And they're not getting paid. And they're not really having the same amount of time to run the council, to be the face of the city, because they've essentially become their city's chief lobbyist. Not that they don't have lobbyists assisting them, but they are the person. Well, if that role is shifting so much, maybe the role as it's defined in the charter needs to shift as well. Because if that city feels like it needs a bigger presence in the legislature, and they want that to be the mayor, maybe the mayor's roles need to be expanded and changed. And you've seen some of that in some of our bigger cities. Some of it, this is the one a lot of us don't like, more accountability. If you piss off your residents enough, they may decide to amend the charter without your help. And we have a few cities in Oregon, unfortunately, who have provisions in their charter that do not allow them to increase fees without a vote of the people. Yeah, everybody knows that one. Yep, Tim's got that one, Mayor Rosner. Yep, Mary Engelke in North Bend. The reason they're imposed is because the city council enacted a fee that the voters didn't like, and the reaction was the voters said, fine, we'll change the charter so you can never do it again without going to a vote of the people. And their basis is accountability. I want the council to be accountable to me before it taxes me or fees me. Whether or not you think that's a good idea or not is up for each of you to decide, but that's becoming a more common example of people trying to make councils and their overall government more accountable to the people. I don't think that's great public policy, because at the end of the day, water costs what water costs, yeah. Right?
Aren't elections accountability?
The question is, aren't elections the accountability? Sure, that's an argument, but I don't think the voters always agree. They just don't. I'm just saying that that is one way the voters have made your charters change for accountability purposes. Some of it's representation. That goes back to the ward issue. How many of you still have mayors that are not elected at large? There's a few, right? So what I'm starting to see and hear rumblings of, so some city councils have the mayors elected from the council itself. It doesn't go to a vote of the people, right? And so you're starting to see some conversations in some communities nationwide as well saying, no. If the mayor's the face of the city and the mayor's the chief executive, I want to decide who the mayor is as a voter. I want that to look different. I don't want to leave it to the council. Right? You're starting to see more examples of wards, right? And then city representatives at large. So you're starting to see a lot more examples of people trying to amend their charter so that the residents and the business owners feel like who gets into that office represents them and their specific will. Right? Another big reason why we want to review is some of you have cyclical requirements. Anybody have a charter that says you have to review it every 5 to 10 years? Like one. Okay, that breaks my heart. As a city attorney for decades, you should be reviewing any ordinance or policy or charter at least every 10 years, guys. I'm not saying that means you change it, but you should at least look at it, because the facts on the ground could change every 5 to 10 years, and you're going to end up with statutes or ordinances or policies you don't care about. And I'll use my own city as an example, right? For whatever reason, back in the day, we decided that if you wanted to operate a circus in my city, you had to pay a $500 business license fee. And we checked for nothing. We didn't decide if the location was appropriate. We didn't check the health of the animals, which really pissed my mayor off. We didn't do anything except make you come in, fill out a 2-page form, and hand me a check for $500. Why? First of all, it's not a moneymaker, because circuses don't come to town even annually. Right? It was just outdated. We had an old ordinance on the books that prohibited people from spitting on the sidewalk. Now, I agree, that's probably gross, but are we really going to enforce that? I also worked in a college town. Those people were drunk all the time. There were way worse things happening on this town. Way worse things. But some of you have charter provisions that require you to review every 5 to 10 years. If you are updating your charter, and in the process of your update, you're like, dang, we should have done this a lot sooner. We missed the mark. We've missed stuff. Think about forcing yourself to do it every 5 to 10 years by putting a provision in your charter that requires it. That's typically why people will review their charters. Any questions? Yes, Sabrina.
So if your charter is out of sync with the law,
yep.
It goes to those people.
So if your charter is out of sync with the law, typically it goes to the vote of the people mm-hmm. to change the charter. How does that work? So it's great to a vote, and they're like, we don't want to follow the law. Yeah. So I'm going to give you two pieces of advice. So the first is, if those are the cases, and we'll get to this a little bit more, is think about how the charter amendment on that piece works. Do that as a standalone, and it's a technical fix only. Don't try and put anything else in it. Not even like changing names or fixing grammar or typos. This is a standalone ballot issue that is only becoming because we are legally required to do it. And in the process of doing that, I would have a lot of town halls where your city attorney is the proverbial bad woman in the room, right? I don't know why, I'm gonna be real honest. If you're a mayor or a city manager, you can say the exact same thing as your city attorney, but when your city attorney says it, somehow that makes it true. It's not fair, it's not rational, but it's true. So that would be my first piece of advice. The second thing is, it wasn't for a charter, but I had similar conversations about some mandatory ordinance changes we had to do a couple years ago, probably 20 years ago now, because of a Supreme Court case that came out. And I literally had to tell people over and over again, whether it was in town halls, neighborhood meetings, or even my own council, you cannot change it, but city employees will follow the law. You cannot ask city employees to knowingly, intentionally, and deliberately violate the law. They won't do it, and we can't do it. So whether you change it or not, we are going to be required by some other form of law to do it differently. So you might as well not put your employees in that position. That's what I would do. Good question. Okay. So, I don't always put quotes in, but I'm a big, big fan of Thomas Jefferson. If you've ever been out to Washington, you see this quote is on his memorial, and he is obviously a character who has pros and cons, but I love this quote. I'm not going to read it to you because there's literally nothing I hate more than somebody reading to me, but the concept of his quote is essentially what I think is applicable to charter reviews. You can pass a law, and you don't want the law to switch, right? You don't want flip-flopping, right? You don't want the law to say one thing in 2025, something else in 2026, to go back in 27, back in 28, different in 29. But you also can't pass a law in 1950 and think that it's still applicable in 2025. Things look differently, right? We just have a different environment. And so what his quote says is essentially this concept that you should be regularly reviewing your laws. And you should accept the fact that some of them are going to have to change. Now, we haven't done it in decades, but even the United States, its own constitution, has been amended. And it's been amended because we figured out we needed to do things differently. It's probably never going to be amended again. That would require way too much cooperation and bipartisan support, but one can dream, right? So I put this on here to say, even when we were starting our country, the people who founded us at least realize that what they were writing was probably not still going to be valid in decades later. And that applies to your charters as well. So make sure you take a concerted effort. And again, I say this all the time, reviewing doesn't have to mean amending, but at least you can honestly look at yourselves and say, what we did 10 years ago still applies today, and we'll come back in another 10 years. Okay, so some emerging trends. I don't like a lot of typing on my PowerPoint. So, terms of office. How many of you have mayor terms that are only 2 years? How many of you find that problematic? Okay, we're starting to see that shift for a couple of reasons. Some, it's because there's arguments that why are mayors being treated differently than the rest of their council? Four works for councils, why doesn't it work for mayors? Some, it's because elections are becoming messier and messier, even at the local level. And so you really only have about a year to get up to speed, and then you're in campaign season. And some talk about the fact that realistically, and I say this to my employees when we hire somebody new, I don't think I get the top 110% I need until the third year. First year, even if it's a lateral move, you're just trying to figure out what the heck is doing, right? Who do I call? Where do I get coffee from? What's that person's name I'm supposed to be friends with, etc. The second year is when you know who to call, you know what you're doing, and you're starting to hit your stride. And the third year is when you become a valuable asset. And I think that applies for elected officials as well. The number of times I do an elected essentials training, somebody's been on the job for 4 months, and they're like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, I thought I was gonna join the city council and we were gonna like fix some potholes, maybe talk about buying a new fire truck, and there's all this other stuff that I didn't know that happened, right? You're drinking from a fire hose the first year. And if you're a big enough city who has lots of departments and lots and lots and lots of issues, you're probably still drinking from a fire hose at year two. So asking somebody to have to rerun every 2 years when they're just trying to understand and actually get a groove into the job is becoming problematic. So you're starting to see a lot more charter amendments focusing on, do those two-year terms make sense, or should we be moving them to four-year terms? And also in terms of office, we have a few small, finite numbers of cities who council terms all end on the same time frame. So every 2 or 4 years, you could have an entirely new council because there's no staggered terms. So for some of our smaller cities, particularly those with charters who have not been updated, we're starting to see them move to staggered terms so they don't have a wholesale replacement every 2 years or every four. One of the new emerging trends is kind of the roles that different people play. And we talked a little bit about this with one of the mayor's roles, right? Like, if the mayor's role is expanding and doing something differently, we're starting to see charter language that changes that. Do we have anybody from Portland in the room? Portland, Edmonton, right? They changed all of their roles when they did their charter amendment. And they did that because what they had, they didn't think was necessarily as effective in what was working. So what I tell people when you do a charter review, don't assume that the roles are outlined in the charter are the roles that have to stay forever. I think a lot of times people get into charter review and you're looking for minor tweaks. Sit down and think about what would our city look like if we built it today, right? If we were an unincorporated area of Oregon and we had to build a charter, are these the actual roles we would have and the responsibilities that go with them? And if the answer is no, have a conversation about why. But we are starting to see a lot more role changes in charters. Lily.
I'm just curious about the difference of,
amending the charter to be more specific. I've always looked at, have the ordinance cover the big stuff, but like fees, have it changed in resolution so you can adjust as needed. If the roles are generic enough in the charter, can you do like an ordinance or something in the rules to get those roles to change, or do you need it that specific in the charter itself?
So no, as long as your charter allows for the council to make policies or adopt policies, they can. What I'm talking about is a more foundational shift. So let's say you want to make the mayor not, you, let's say you wanted to go, and I'm not suggesting this to the city managers in the room, so please do not hear. Let's say you didn't want, you wanted to go from a council manager form of government to a strong mayor form of government. I said, don't get mad. That would be a foundational role shift for the mayor. If you wanted to do some of the hybrids you've seen from Portland and Beaverton, where it's still technically a council manager, but the mayor has this new kind of unique role that's not stereotypical, those would be things you would want to see in the charter. So it's what I would call a foundational shift in the role. Another one that we're seeing relates to the attorneys and the judges. How many of you have a city attorney? Please, everybody, raise your hand.
So even if contracted out.
Even if contracted out, yes. Okay, how many of you have a charter provision that says the attorney is appointed by the city council?
Hired.
Fired by the city attorney? Who does the city attorney do most of the work for?
City manager.
So, what, I'm not taking a position on whether the city attorney should report to council or report to manager. But you are starting to hear conversations in city councils, even here in Oregon, who are recognizing that there is a slight disconnect and that the person who is hiring the city attorney is only gets them like 5% of the time. And 95% of the work the city attorney does is actually reporting to the city manager. So you're starting to have some conversations in charter amendments about, does that role need to shift? How many of you have municipal judges? Are they elected? Okay, some still are. And again, I'm not taking a position on whether or not that is good or bad, but for those that still have municipally elected judges, I'm starting to see shifts where they become appointed by the city council. If that's where you're going, that's great, but I would ask you to think about the same question. If you are going to appoint the city judge, the municipal judge, are you also going to supervise them? Because if you want to fire them, what are you firing them based on? Right? So just think about that if you're going to pivot to an in-house municipal judge that's appointed. Who is the supervising authority? Lily?
On that topic as well, if your charter or your code says the municipal judge is the appeal process to the council, there could be some ethical circles there if that's the supervisor who's appealing them. Which is why you should all have city attorneys if you do a charter review. Okay, vacancies. This is problematic even for some of the newer charters. So, what happens when there's a vacancy on the council? And there's two big problems I see. One, who fills the vacancy? Is that the council? Yes? Right? What happens if you have a 5-member council and 3 members resign? And everybody chuckles. That's a real thing. It's happened multiple times. So who appoints if you don't have quorum? Under state law, the state could give that power to the county. And that's happened in 2 cities in the last 2 years. Right? Now, the statute says they can only appoint enough to fill you to a quorum, and then the council will fill the rest. But there's a gap. If you don't have that spelled out in the charter, you could essentially be delegating that authority to the county commission. If you like your county commission, that's great. If you don't like your county commission, that could be problematic. The other thing that's problematic with vacancies that we still see in some charter provisions, and we're starting to see people recognize and change, is what does a vacancy mean for quorum? Some of our really old charters, for example, if they have 7-member councils, will specifically say that a quorum is 4. Well, that's a problem if I have 3 vacancies. So what we're starting to see is people change the vacancy language. And so when they're amending their charters, they're saying things like, vacancies don't count for quorum purposes. Meaning, if you reduce yourself to a 4-member council because of resignations or people have just left, then your quorum is no longer 4 for the 7. It's now 3 because you've gone to a 4-member council. So these are technical glitches, but the reason I'm calling it one of our emerging trends is because we've started to see cities on almost a yearly basis run into problems specifically related to the vacancy language in their charter because it's not clear enough as to what happens under all the different possible worst-case scenarios. Another trend is, it kind of goes hand in hand, is quorum. So the same thing coming up with vacancies. What is a quorum? Is it a solid number you put in there? Or is it a vacancy level? And I'm going to tell you the con for just leaving it on the majority of the council members present. Anybody in 9-member council? A few of you. Okay, let's say everybody resigns and you only have 2 members left. But your charter says quorum can still be 2 because we don't count vacancies to quorum. Is it appropriate for only 2 members of your community of, say, 40,000 people to basically build an entire new council with no public input? That could be dangerous, right? So you've got to think about what that looks like in terms of quorum purposes. I can argue both sides, what I get paid to do, or used to get paid to do. But think about what it means in terms of a nuance. If you don't have a set number, or you don't want it to just be quorum for the 9 members, you don't want it just to be 5, because maybe you're like, okay, we could at least be comfortable with 4 people making that decision. Maybe you put a lower number in if there's vacancies. But these are real problems that the league has been asked to address and help city attorneys with over the last 2 to 4 years. Another change in emerging trends is home rule. Does everybody know what home rule is? Save space if you don't. Okay? So, how many of you feel like the state government has been preempting your home rule? I thought there would be yells. Okay, too much? So we're starting to see some cities, as they work on their charter amendments, try and push the boundaries of what home rule is and what it really means. Mayor Rosner, are you here? Okay. Everybody's pointing at Mayor Rosner. Okay, so Sherwood, and I think this is fair, would it be fair to say you passed your recent charter amendment expecting to be sued?
Yes.
Okay. And the reason, so they've changed, they're unhappy, and if I speak wrongly, you should yell at me. I think it's safe to say the city of Sherwood is unhappy with some of the land use preemptions that have been imposed upon cities over the last years. Okay, not throwing anything at me yet. So they've enacted 2 provisions just very recently through their voters that was very well received with a high voter turnout to essentially challenge and try and restore home rule back into their charter, requiring voter-approved annexations and dealing with some mandatory public hearing processes for land use decisions that might conflict with state law. The theory being that they will get sued, and eventually work its way up through the appellate courts to try and overturn and solidify home rule through the judicial system to kind of check the legislature in its preemptions. Is that fair? Close enough.
Close enough.
Close enough. Yeah. So, I don't think that that will be the end. What I expect will happen, and that's not just here in Oregon, and talking with some of my colleagues in other state leagues, there are a couple other home rule states where they've got some cities who are eventually saying, we want to create a fact pattern so solid that our voters approve in the charter that if we get sued, we might have a better fact to take to the Court of Appeals or the state Supreme Court to overturn the legislature on our behalf because of home rule in our Constitution. So it's not just Sherwood here. There are other cities and other states who are trying to do the same thing, essentially do an end run around the legislature and let the judiciary say, look, home rule's protected in our state constitution. You've gone too far. Another emerging trend is the wards. I'm starting to see more and more people go to the wards. I don't know if, if you have a city of Fossil, I don't know if Mayor McInnes is in here, does less than 300 or 400 residents. I don't know if the wards make sense. You know, if you don't have a stop sign, stop light, maybe it doesn't make sense, right? That's not a criticism or a joke. It's just, maybe it's just not big enough. But I mean, if I'm the city of Eugene, maybe it does, right? I don't know if they do or not. They do. Thank you. Right? Compensation. You already raised your hand about how little you are. How many of your cities have started talking about whether or not elected officials should be compensated? This is a safe space. I'm not a voter. I will tell you this, as the league's executive director and as somebody who's worked for municipalities for almost 30 years, I do think the job has shifted for elected officials. And again, I can argue both sides. There's something about saying, look, we still want this to be community-minded and civic-minded. We don't want mayors and councilors to be a job that people just take because they're looking for salary, they're looking for benefits, or looking for health insurance. We want like this whole civic-mindedness engagement. I get that argument. But it's also true that if I'm a volunteer mayor and I'm expected to do my job well as a mayor and I'm working 50 hours a week and I have to put food on the table, maybe I should be compensated more than $22 a month. So I say this to say that I think it's becoming more and more popular. It's not the norm, but I think compensation conversations for elected officials is becoming more common in charter discussions. Because I think it's going to the efficacy of how you can do your job. Another argument in favor of it is saying, look, if you don't want, and this is not a criticism of those who you are, if you don't want a council that is comprised entirely of retirees or independently wealthy individuals, most of us are gonna need to be compensated more than $22 a month to do the work. Because if you want 25-year-old teachers to sit on city council, they can't quit their job to do 40 hours worth of work for the city. So there's arguments on both sides. I'm a home rule believer to my core. It's up to each city to decide what they want. But if you're going to do a charter amendment soon, I would tell you that you should expect a conversation about compensation for your elected officials. Yeah. Residency requirements. This is for your city managers. How many of you have charter requirements that require your city managers to live inside the city limits? County limits. Okay, I'm not taking a position on that. What I will tell you is that a lot of cities in this state and nationally who have had those when they update their charters are looking at changing that because of recruitment efforts. Because it's limiting their pool, and some of them, particularly in tightly urban compacted areas, so like the metro area of Portland, does it really matter if I get hired in, Robbie wins the lottery and decides to leave Hillsboro because he can? Hold on, you're going to get me instead. Kidding, Robbie. Your job's harder. So Robbie wins the lottery. He leaves the city of Hillsboro as their city manager. I don't, but I live in Beaverton and I have a house there. Am I really going to be expected to sell my house in Beaverton, pull my kids out of the Beaverton School District, all their extracurricular activities, and move 10 miles to Hillsboro so I can be their city manager? Maybe that's what you think is right. Maybe that's what you think is wrong. But we have heard, even from recruiters when we go to national conferences, those residency requirements on city managers are starting to become a burden for a lot of cities. There are benefits for why you want city managers to live in your community, right? You want them to be your community. You want them to understand your community. You want them to be part of the community. And those are all valid reasons. Another problem, what we're hearing from some of the recruiters, or I hear from city managers sometimes, is this is not the best political environment. People are not as respectful as they were even 10 or 15 years ago. And while you, as mayor, may not be able to go into the grocery store and get up a watermelon without being yelled at 25 times, city managers are kind of feeling the same thing. They're like, look, I'd like to be able to go to my kid's Little League game and not have to spend the whole game answering questions about water rates, trash hauling services, and why that police officer still has a job. So, again, I take no position on what you want to do, but that is an emerging trend to try and increase your retention efforts and to try and increase mental health. But it does mean they may not be a member of your community in the way your community is normally used to. There are pros and cons both ways, but it's a trend we're starting to see discussed. Another big one, these are three new ones. They're not necessarily here, a little bit here, but more in some of the states, particularly on the East Coast or in California. Is taking some of your social equity positions, your diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility work, and embedding them into your actual charter. The concept for those cities who have done it is to say, if the charter is supposed to be our city's quote-unquote constitution, then it needs to have values in it, the same way the U.S. Constitution does. We need to set up who we are as a city, what we mean, what we care about, and what matters to us in our actual charter. And so you're starting to see some cities do that. Most are still doing them through ordinances or policies or resolutions, but there have been some cities, particularly in the far New England states, who are starting to embed them in their charters. And in my experience, what happens in one state eventually works its way to others. Yep.
Hold on.
Angela's going to give you a mic.
I was curious about this because I know Portland did some of that in their city charter. And I guess I'm just curious, like, what does that actually mean? Because I know, like, for, like, the charter reform for Portland, it says, like, the mayor will advance Portland's climate. Like, what happens if the mayor doesn't advance climate goals?
Yeah.
Like, it just feels kind of empty.
It feels empty. So what I'm going to not give you legal advice, but I'm going to tell you how I would analyze something we do from a legal perspective. So the framework, I think, from any good lawyer, when we're giving you legal advice on whether you should do a project, a program, spend money, is we look at your guiding foundational documents. So I'm going to start with your city charter. And if it, for example, tells me that climate change and impacts are something I need to look at, or we can't discriminate against people because of gender, if that's in my charter, that's going to be a framework I have to review any new ordinance you want me to help you craft and adopt. And if it doesn't match your charter, then I have an obligation to say, hey, look, this proposal that you want to put before the city council for a municipal code update, it's going to run into a problem with your charter. Because you know, if it's gender discrimination, right, we don't want that. You're going to, and please tell me nobody would do this, but these are extreme examples, right? But we're going to have a parks program, summer program for the kids. And we're going to charge the parents of little boys $20 all day and the parents of little girls $40 all day. Right, that'd be a problem, we should all know it. But when I'm doing that analysis, part of my analysis would be to go back to the charter and say, look, you're going to specifically violate Article 1, Section 2.5 of your charter if you do this. So there is some merit. Now there's like the teeth, like if the mayor doesn't do what he's supposed to, then you could arguably have the city council sue them and make it give them a message really fast. But generally speaking, it's supposed to be an additional lens by which you make major policy decisions for as a community. Good question. Yep. Oh, sorry. Mayor Morgan. Let's see.
I just want to go back to the residency requirement for just a minute because I've had people mention this to me as far as being city councilors or the mayor, and it's like, well, why can't we have two of our city councilors not live in the city but be business owners or live in urban growth boundary? And so is there any discussion on that? I'd just be interested to hear that.
Great question, Mayor Morgan. We have two cities that actually have amended their residency requirements for that. So smallest city in Oregon, anybody know who's not on LLC staff? Greenhorn. That's not fair. You're a former LLC board member. Okay. Greenhorn is the smallest city in Oregon. Has three people in it. Nobody lives there full time. So they don't. Their residency requirement to sit on the city council is just that you own property in Greenhorn. Their mayor lives in Southeast Portland. The city of Detroit, it also has a residency requirement that not the whole council, but a certain percentage of the council can just be property owners in the city and they can live somewhere else because they have a heavy like summer population, residency population. So I think that it should be whatever works best for your council, but I think you should be clear on what that means and what it looks like. I know that Detroit has struggled with some of its charter amendments around that, and it did create some rifts between, particularly after the Santiam Canyon fires, right? Mm-hmm. As former Mayor Trett used to say, Detroit looks a lot different today than it did before the fire. And if you've driven past it, you know what I mean. So it has created tension. And I would say with some of the charter amendments I've seen, I think what Detroit went through when it was amending its charter to allow that was probably some of the more complicated, what I would say, community conversations I've seen around charter amendments. So I think you can do it. I'd just be mindful of what your constituency base looks like. You don't want it. Okay, good. The new one, Privacy AI. So there's no city councils working on this one yet, but there are a bunch of citizen-led initiative petitions to start to change charters to put in, like, AI privacy bill of rights into your charters, because people are super worried about what AI means to them and their everyday lives. They're worried about how their local government will use AI against them. I don't believe cities actually do anything against their constituents, but maybe I'm Pollyanna. And then what that means for privacy. And so, again, I'm not aware of, and I did a pretty exhaustive search a couple weeks ago, I'm not aware of any what I would call city council or city staff-led initiatives. But there are several beginning to have conversations, and Washington State is the closest one, where you have some cities who are citizens who are starting to do initiative-led petitions to amend charters to allow these. I'm not going to take a position on this, but what I would say, this is a very emerging and new technology, and putting something like that in your charter when we still don't understand its long-term impacts, and I'm saying this is somebody who is super nervous about AI. I probably sound like a conspiracy theorist when I talk about it, but I do think it's emerging, and to put something like that in your charter might be risky at this point, but I would be prepared for it if you live in a community that has strong concerns about AI and its impact, because simple Google searches and they can start to find people in other states who are thinking about it. And then the last one I'm excited about is because I think that we don't have enough civic engagement from young people in this country, which is part of the reason why we have a lack of civic understanding, is youth participation. This started with school board associations, and it started in California, where several school boards amended their policies and rules in two ways: to let 16 and 17-year-olds begin to vote on who served on school boards, and to allow them to become school board members. The theory being, the people those boards are ultimately responsible to are the students, so maybe the students should have a say in the policies that are being enacted against them. There's at least one city in Vermont who has done the same thing at the city election level. So there's one city in Vermont who now says 16 and 17-year-olds can vote in citywide elections, and they can serve in elected office. I know, wow, right? I think it might be great to let them vote. Personally, I might be a little nervous if my mayor client was 16 years old. Having raised teenagers, that would make me very uncomfortable. I'm going to go, Lily, and then I'll go back to Mayor Graham.
Wait, I'm just curious, can cities encumber the county clerks to run an election that they wouldn't otherwise do? Or are cities going to have to pay the bill to allow the 16 and 17-year-olds to vote?
It's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I honestly don't know the answer. It's something you'd have to study if you wanted it. But I do think there are several, we'll go to Mayor Graham. There are several cities, I know there are lots in the metro region, and I know Hermiston and Eastern Oregon are really building up youth programs, right? You've seen the value in getting high school students engaged in your processes. If this is an emerging trend that we're starting to see in neighboring cities and on school boards, it's reasonable to assume this could become something that we're talking about in 5 or 6 years here in Oregon. Mayor Graham.
So we recently added a student, a youth positions onto our city committees, but we've been saying that they can't vote until they get to the age of 18 on those committees because we understood the state law wouldn't allow them to do that in relation to the council. But so is there anything at the state level that precludes either that at the committee level or at the city council level, anyone who's younger voting than 18?
I don't know the answer on the council level. I would suggest that depending on the way your charter currently reads, if it's a charter-created committee that isn't making what I would consider, I would say you probably have more flexibility on your committee. I don't know about the council yet because I didn't look at it. I just looked to see where people were going with trends. In full honesty. Angela, am I done in 15 minutes? Okay, so some yellow and red flags. Terms of office, we kind of talked about this. So staggered terms, look at your charter, do your staggered terms work? And do the starting times and ending times of your terms match up? So in some really old charter language, there's language that says, for example, that, well, I would never be in elected office, Mayor Pace for the city of Hillsborough. Mayor Pace, that she's elected, her term ends on December 31st, 2029. Yep, okay, she thinks so, 2029. But then it says that whether it's Mayor Pace or if it's somebody else, because she wins the lottery with Robbie, they split the ticket, she's like, peace out, I'm done. Moving to Indiana with my kids because I love it there so much. Go Hoosiers.
Go Hoosiers.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. So she's going to be done at the end of 2029. But her replacement, her term doesn't begin until she takes the oath of office. And the oath of office isn't scheduled until January 15th. Who's in charge between January 1st and January 15th? City manager. Woo-hoo! You might make the elected officials mad. But those are one of the red flags that we see sometimes in charters when we take a look at them, is because it could become an issue. I would suggest as a city attorney that I would say it's not actually December 31st. It's still whoever is sworn in is sworn in. I can make arguments either way. But it is a nuanced provision where there's some gaps, so you might want to take a look. Because if your term ends on December 31st, and your predecessor does not take office until you swear them in, and you're not swearing them in on January 1st, you technically have a gap. And somebody's going to have to interpret what that gap means. Super. Yes, Mayor Johnson.
Our charter, I believe, we get sworn in before the 31st, so on the first I get sworn in, my ceremony gets sworn in.
Yes, you don't have that problem, but there are charters that do. Supervision of council employees. So, you hire, and you can fire the city attorney. How many of you evaluate them and supervise them? A few. Most of you don't. What does that mean? I'm not suggesting I have an answer for you, but that is a problem in your charter. If you're responsible for hiring and firing somebody, that probably means you should also be responsible for supervising them. And if you don't have a method by which you're supervising them, how does that work? And what does that mean? Same thing for the municipal judge. And I would suggest, as a favor to my city managers, if you are responsible for hiring and firing the city attorney, but you think the city manager should be responsible for managing them, you might want to have a conversation about what that looks like with your city manager. Because as a manager myself, if I don't have the authority to discipline, reprimand, or ultimately terminate somebody you want me to supervise, you've put me in a pretty untenable situation. Because I can't rectify a problem. So you should think about that in your charters. I'm not saying that means they shouldn't be supervised or they shouldn't be hired by you, but if you're going to hire them, you probably should be the one supervising and evaluating them. We've talked about vacancies. One of the ones we didn't talk about, though, is hybrid meetings. Some of you have really old charter language that says a vacancy occurs if you're living outside, if you're outside the city limits for 30 or 60 days. Because it was written in 1950 before we imagined we could have an effective virtual meeting while you're in Spain.
It's still in your model chart.
Yeah. We'll work on that. So what I would say is, look at your charter if you're doing a charter amendment. What does the vacancy mean in terms of how long you can be out of the city limits, and does that impact hybrid meetings? Because if you are somebody who regularly doesn't care about that, now, I would argue that perhaps somebody who doesn't actually live in your city for 6 to 9 months out of the year might have different implications that you should talk about, but take a look at it. The other one that has come up, not as much, but has created some flags that we've worked on at the league, is can vacancies remain open endlessly? The majority doesn't want to fill the vacancy, and it's going to be vacant for 18 months. Are you, as a community, okay with that? Maybe you are, maybe you're not. But when you call the league or your city attorney calls the league and we get two or three similar complaints and they're all saying we've got one section that wants to fill the vacancy but the majority doesn't want to fill the vacancy, they just want to leave it open, the citizens and the residents and business owners are starting to get upset, that's a flag for us that you should take a look at. Because most charters still today do not tell you how long the council can leave a position open, vacant.
What if there are absences?
Then you should just appoint somebody that you voluntold. Sorry, I'm being facetious. I don't know what happens if you don't get any applicants, but there are some who have created what I would call some partisan politic issues, even though we're all supposed to be nonpartisan. Agendas. This one I would like to think could be resolved amicably, but I have multiple instances of this state and other states where it's not, is you have charter provisions that specifically say who sets the agenda. So a couple that specifically come to mind is the agenda setting responsibility rests solely with the mayor. And the mayor is not in alignment with several council members. and the council members want to get something on the agenda, and the mayor refuses to put it on the agenda. So now you've got council members mad at the mayor, you've got a city manager who's stuck in the middle and is like, look, I can't get it on there, I don't know what you want me to do, right? Or you don't allow the city manager to put something on the agenda. And while they're not the policy makers, they are usually the people who know when you have to change things because of the law, or because something is broken, or because you need a new fee. So some of the charters that haven't been amended in a while have really strict and limiting requirements on who can set the agenda. And we have seen it multiple times that the league creates some pretty intense conflict among city councils, and has put city managers in some really strong binds, because you're basically putting them in the middle between warring factions on a council. So if you're going to do an update, take a look at who sets the agenda setting. Another problematic is some really old charters set a very specific process for the agenda. Like, they actually lay out the order in which things can be determined. That's, in my opinion, a little too specific for your charter, and it creates some problematic meeting flow issues if you have them. And so if you've got a charter that's really specific, I am actually going to give you advice and say, take that out of the charter and make that a little bit more of council rules of procedure with some flexibility. But I still see charters every once in a while that will literally say, call to order, pledge of allegiance, and then you're going through all of these things. That's probably not appropriate in your charter. The last two are just pet peeves of mine as an attorney and an anal retentive person. Grammar inconsistent terms. There are certain spelling mistakes in charters. Here's the thing, if you call the city manager, don't seven sections later call him the city administrator. So a lot, and it's not a crit, I mean, it just makes me twitchy, but if you're going to fix your charter, see if you've got inconsistent terminologies, right? If you refer to the police chief for some reason in the charter, it's police chief, not chief of police two sections later, right? Like, keep some consistency. Double check for spelling, double check for, you know, sentence structures, right? There's a whole new movement to not do double spacing and only do single spacing. It's a constant battle between Gen Z and millennials and Gen Xers and boomers. I don't care. I mean, I do care. I prefer single, but do whatever. The last one is specificity. I do agree that charters should generally not be so specific that there is no movement. So what I tell people is, what are you trying to do, and how easily do you want it to be amendable if you have to change? Right? If you're not somebody who's going to review your charter every year, then maybe it should be less specific. Because if you put it in the charter and it has to go to the vote of the people, you can't change it unless they agree with you. So be mindful of how specific you want to be in your charters. Okay, processes that work well. Deep community engagement. I know sometimes it's super annoying to go to 45 town halls and 26 neighborhood meetings and the chamber meeting and the rotary meeting and the downtown business association meeting. But if you go back to the actual basic concept of local government in a home rule state, we work for the people. This is not your charter. This is not the council's charter. This is not staff's charter. This is a city residents charter. The same way the U.S. Constitution is not Congress's constitution. It's our constitution. So if you believe foundationally in that concept, then you need to make sure that what you're putting together is what the constituents are asking for and want. And sometimes they do things that we hate. Sometimes they do things that are not great public policy. But at the foundational root core of a home rule concept, that document belongs to them. So you should take the time to hear what they want. I'm a big fan of the two-phased approach. If you have technical fixes or non-controversial fixes and a controversial or major substantive fix, don't run them on the same ballot. Because if there's a chance that they're going to vote down the controversial one and you have it on the same ballot as all the technical fixes you need, all your technical fixes just failed too. Run two separate ballots. Right? If you're going to suddenly change and go to something ranked choice voting, that would be pretty controversial and pretty new. But you've got to do a couple fixes to the charter because state law changed and you need to be in compliance with state law. Don't put them on at the same time. Because you're going to end up potentially killing the stuff that nobody cares about because you've wrapped them all into one ballot. I'm personally a big fan of charter committees for two reasons. One, I think it ensures that you have residential engagement in terms of the process, but it also gives you some cover. And I'm a big fan of giving people cover. right? Not all ideas are bad, and sometimes being able to say, look, this wasn't city council leading this. This was a charter committee that was leading it. It's not a power grab by the city council to do something you don't like. That doesn't mean city council doesn't have input. It doesn't mean you give them suggestions. It doesn't mean you don't raise concerns. It doesn't mean staff doesn't participate. But if you have a charter committee, you can more confidently say this was a citizen-led initiative, and it wasn't something that the council was doing against what the residents wanted. Hopefully the first three make it clear. You should have long runways on this 99% of the time. Most charter review processes are not something you should try and knock out in 90 days from start to finish. Okay? There could be examples where you might need an emergency, or it really is just a quick technical fix that nobody cares about, and you're like, why not? You know, there's no levies on the ballot. Nobody's going to care. We might as well knock it out. But normally speaking, you should plan to have a really long runway before you do this. Where does it go wrong? Kind of the opposite. The kitchen sink method. And there's lots of examples of this, where charter provisions fail because you put 45 potential changes into the ballot. And if I look at them and I'm like, well, I love 43, but those other two I could never freaking live with, and I only have the option of a yes or no vote, I will vote no. They historically fail. Power grabs. If it looks like the only people involved, for example, I'm the mayor. I would never be the mayor, but I'm the mayor. I have a 2-year term limit. I don't want to go to 4 years. And I'm the person who proposes it. I'm the public proponent. I'm the only person speaking about it, and we only do it as a council without going to the citizens. What does it look like? It looks like I'm trying to grab power. If the council are the only people talking about council compensation, if they start the conversation, they're the leaders of the conversation, and they're the only ones in the conversation, it looks like you're trying to do public service at a cost to the taxpayers. Be mindful of the perception of you attempting to usurp some power. In my experience as a lawyer, rushing seldom works out in our best interests. It doesn't mean you take 5 years. It doesn't even mean you take 3 years. But if you're rushing, you're probably making a mistake. If you're rushing, you're probably not asking and talking to everybody you should be about the changes you're making. Most of them do. You know who the influential people are in your community. You know who the squeaky wheels are in your community. And those squeaky wheels are never fun to talk to. But if you miss them, they will become your biggest enemy. So take the time to talk to them. Ballot fatigue. Same way you all are survey fatigued from the league. At some point, your voters are just flipping tired of voting on things that you put in front of them. And the problem is you're not in it alone. You could have special districts that are constantly putting forward voting measures. You could have counties. The state, in its infinite wisdom, could have things in front of you. Ballot fatigue is becoming a real thing. When I was doing my research for this presentation, I didn't know it, but the city of San Francisco in particular, they averaged for a long time like a new ballot measure every year. At some point, the voters are like, I'm out, I'm done. Like, it can't be that hard. Like, I don't need to be doing this year over year. And that was for the charter, I want to be clear. That was not like on funding issues. That was like a charter amendment every year. So be mindful of their ballot fatigue, particularly if it's something that you passionately believe needs to be passed. And last, court battle. So there was a case from the city of Austin in Texas. I know we're not Texas, and I know we're not the city of Austin. They were pushing the limits on what they thought they could do with their charter, despite legal advice suggesting it would flagrantly violate state law. And they were going to do it anyway. It did pass with decent amount of voter support. And then the city spent 2.5 years in litigation with the state, ultimately lost. And according to the Texas League director, they estimate the city spent several hundred thousands of dollars of taxpayer funds on top of thousands of hours of staff time on an initiative that they knew basically was going to fail from the beginning to make a point. Now, while their residents may have theoretically been okay with it, what it did say was that it did erode confidence and trust overall in the long term, and it did call into question some of their city attorney's advices from the constituents. People lost faith because they weren't listening to the nuances. So just be mindful that while I'm a big fan sometimes of picking a fight to change the law, ask yourself what the return on investment is and the cost-benefit analysis. So that's it. I'm probably right at time. Angela's yelling at me. So if you have questions, you can come find me after. She didn't yell. She's just shaking her head at me. So if you have questions, you can come find me after. You can find me today. We're going back to the big hall after a break for lunch and our keynote speaker. Thank you all. Oh, CM's coming up because I missed his step.